Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Almost every single day, children pay the price for the bad choices that adults make. They're left to die in hot cars. They're sent into foster care while their parents make their way through the prison system. They're left in sleazy motels while their guardian tries to get their next drug fix. They're sexually abused or beaten by a relative supposed to care for them. Sometimes the simple proximity to bad decisions can make children vulnerable. We all feel rage at the casual indifference in which adults drag children along in the wake of their bad decisions. And in Arlington, Texas, in 1994, a teenage girl paid the ultimate price for the stupid actions of her older brothers. Sixteen-year-old Lisa Renee lived in the Polo Run apartment in Arlington, Texas, with her brother Neil, her sister Pearl, and Pearl's boyfriend, Henry Byron. Lisa's parents lived in the Virgin Islands. Lisa and Neil had only recently moved from the Virgin Islands to Arlington. Lisa was a student at Lamar High School and was an extremely quiet and dedicated young girl, often spending her weekends studying. She had big ambitions to go to college and study medicine. Before coming to Arlington, Lisa had worked as a teacher's aide, helping troubled children. According to her 22-year-old sister, Pearl, Lisa was particularly shy. She wasn't the kind of girl to start up a conversation, and she only had a few close friends. One friend, Samira Leary, said that Lisa always had a smile on her face that said, "I'm happy to be here." Instead of partying, Lisa preferred to hang out with her siblings. It was shortly after 8 p.m. on the 24th of September, 1994, when Arlington police received a frantic phone call from Lisa. She was home alone doing her homework. Pearl was at work and Neil was at a Caribbean festival. Lisa told the 911 operator that three African-American men were attempting to break into the apartment. In the background, men can be heard trying to talk Lisa into opening the front door. However, when she refused, they can be heard smashing the glass and breaking through. Screams and the sound of a struggle could be heard, as well as one man identifying himself as somebody in the FBI.
Who are you?
I'm the FBI.
Oh, they're the FBI.
Open
the door. No, what's up? They're the FBI. They say they're the FBI, ma'am. No!
However, the phone line soon went dead. Shortly before the 911 call, Lisa had called Pearl, who was at her job in an Arlington motel. When Pearl answered the phone, Lisa's voice quivered as she told her sister that somebody was breaking into the apartment.
A minute later, the phone rings. She said, "Pearl, someone is breaking into the house. Come home as soon as possible. It's a man." And I told her to hang up and dial 911.
Pearl told Lisa to call 911 before abandoning her desk at the hotel and driving back to the apartment as fast as she possibly could. When police arrived at Lisa's apartment block at 1526 Chucka Drive, the glass sliding door in Lisa's bedroom had been smashed and the glass was scattered across the apartment. Lisa was nowhere to be seen. The lead investigator on the case was Detective John Stanton.
From the initial 911 call, it sounded like a very serious kidnapping. It sounded to the 911 call takers that there was some foul play and some actual violence involved. For a 16-year-old to be physically dragged from a residence in Arlington is just, it's really kind of unspeakable.
Several of Lisa's neighbors told police that they had seen a suspicious car parked in Lisa's apartment block in the days running up to Lisa's abduction. It was a tan or brown two-door Cadillac with a partial vinyl top and a license plate that started with WD. According to witnesses, there were three males in the car. One was wearing camouflage, the second was wearing all black, and the third was wearing a white shirt and hat. Lisa's 18-year-old brother, Neil, said that he had seen a man wearing camouflage at around 1 a.m. the night before as he was loading his rental car for an upcoming trip to Houston. According to Neil, the man was acting very suspiciously. He glanced into the trunk of Neil's rental car, where his packed bags were in clear view, before he quickly walked to join the two other men that were standing near a building next to the apartment. Other than this, police had very little tips to go on. They ruled out robbery as a motive early on in the investigation, since nothing was stolen from the apartment. There had even been a solid gold chain in view. Lisa's family were all interviewed to see if there was anybody who could have a grudge against Lisa or anybody else in the family. They told police that they could think of nobody. Lisa had only been living in Arlington for around 6 months, and she mostly kept to herself, only having a few friends. Pearl spoke to the media and relayed her belief that the abductors must have been watching Lisa before abducting her. Missing person posters were distributed throughout the city by Lisa's siblings. They described Lisa as African American, 5 feet 8 inches tall, and her dark hair was braided, and she was wearing a white t-shirt, denim jacket, and green shorts.
We're trying our best to see if we can find anybody who saw the car or see the car anywhere, or the guys.
It is a plea many strangers have already heard and more will. Lisa Renee's family is convinced someone knows what happened to her. They're putting up flyers with her picture throughout Dallas-Fort Worth, hoping someone steps forward with information.
Hopefully, you know, somebody might stop at these lights and, you know, see one of these pictures and say, hey, I recognize this girl.
Really, we're not getting much closer at this point, unfortunately.
Arlington police say a motive would help solve the case, but so far there's not one. They are working under the assumption, though, the kidnappers targeted Lisa or her family.
It just doesn't fit the pattern of any kind of random crime. I mean, there's got to be a reason.
Lisa was kidnapped Saturday night from the North Arlington apartment she shared with her brother and sister. Lisa was on the phone with a 911 operator when three men broke into the apartment and took the girl.
All I want, please, to let Lisa come home safe.
Lisa's family is keeping a vigil at the apartment, hoping for a phone call that will say Lisa is all right. But concern grows with each passing moment.
By the following day, the FBI had joined in on the search. And next, we will hear from Special Agent Kenneth Persona.
The atmosphere at the crime scene was tense. Lisa Renee's sister was very distraught that she wasn't there for her sister. And also, residents in the complex were disturbed that a young lady could be abducted from an apartment complex so readily.
Lisa's mother, Agnes, flew from her home in the Virgin Islands to be with her children in Arlington. Quote, "There's hundreds of people praying for Lisa to come home safe, and I just hope and pray that the people who have her don't hurt her," end quote, she said. She told the Fort Worth Star newspaper that Lisa was her right hand because she was such an obedient and helpful daughter. While they didn't live together, Lisa and Agnes always spoke on the phone and told each other just how much they loved each other and missed one another. Lisa's father, Nicholson, stayed behind in the Virgin Islands to tend to their business and look after their two other daughters. Police soon announced to the public that they had no suspects, but that they had received numerous calls from people who believed they had seen the Cadillac. Meanwhile, Lisa's family made an appeal to her kidnappers. Quote, "Tell them to please let Lisa go. Call if you want something. Whatever it is, just call us. Please, just let her come home. She's only 16, end quote, said Pearl. By day three of Lisa's disappearance, the case began to generate a flurry of national media attention. ABC News filmed a segment on the disappearance, while Lisa's family were asked to come on Maury Povich. Police spokesman Dee Anderson said that investigators were hoping that the additional media coverage would help lead to Lisa. Quote, "Certainly the more exposure, the more potential there is that someone will see it who knows something," end quote, he said. When there were no more leads to follow, police decided to publicly release the 911 call in the hopes that somebody could identify one of the male voices. Detective John Stanton recalls the public reaction to the abduction.
It was truly something that brought out the public and the public's fears about being abducted out of your own residence. It's sort of something that you're not expecting in a community like Arlington. It's not something that's ordinary. This doesn't happen here, I would say, ever in a town that like ours.
On the fourth day, Officer D. Anderson announced that investigators now believed that Lisa was targeted for a specific reason, suggesting that the kidnappers were possibly trying to get at her family through her. Quote, "Admittedly, that is an assumption on our part, but there is nothing to prove it was a random kidnapping," end quote, he said. Shortly thereafter, it was reported in the media that Lisa's brothers had been arrested the month before in Irving and charged with possession of narcotics. At the time of their sister's abduction, they had been out on bond. This revelation led police to begin investigating whether Lisa's abduction was somehow connected to the arrests of Stanfield and Neil, her brothers. The brothers strongly denied that their arrests had anything to do with Lisa's abduction and shared their gripes with the insinuations that they may know who abducted their sister. The very next day, acting on a tip from Texas, police in Arkansas stopped a car at around 8 a.m. in El Dorado and arrested two men and said they were looking for another in connection with Lisa's abduction. The two arrested men were identified as 19-year-old Demetrius Kenyon Hall of El Dorado and 22-year-old Stephen Beckley of Irving. The third suspect was Hall's 23-year-old brother, Orlando Hall. The arrest warrants accused the three men of aggravated kidnapping and recommended a bail of $100,000 for each.
It was an unusual tip for the brothers to have just barely gotten into Arlington, to have had them drive mysteriously to a residence in Irving, Texas, which is some distance from Arlington, and in that same bit of circumstance, find a Cadillac fitting that general description, we thought was very curious.
All three men were known to law enforcement for various drug charges, Orlando Hall in particular.
When I spoke to the people in El Dorado, they were aware of the Hall family. In fact, they were providing to me information about the Hall brothers before I could even give them the information about the Hall brothers. They were well known to law enforcement in the community.
Orlando was a recent parolee with a string of weapons and drug offenses. Just recently, he had been paroled from a 17-year prison term for cocaine trafficking. According to one local prosecutor, Orlando Hall was one of the top three drug dealers in El Dorado. He had a 19-page printout of arrests and convictions ranging from traffic stops to felony cocaine possession and attempted murder. However, the attempted murder charge was dropped. Demetrius Hall had one 1992 felony conviction for cocaine possession. At the time of Lisa's abduction, he was on 5 years probation. Demetrius also had a juvenile record. According to police, the abduction of Lisa was retaliation for a bad drug deal involving her brothers, Stanfield and Neil.
To the brothers, I spoke with Stanfield initially. Stanfield told me that they don't know of anyone who would have wanted to abduct their sister. They owed no one money, that this was not about any sort of drug business. They weren't involved in anything involving drugs.
It was reported that Beckley had given the brothers a $5,000 advance for marijuana, but the brothers never produced the product. In fact, earlier on in the investigation, Stanfield and Neil had attempted to lead police to Beckley, telling them that he may have retaliated because he believed he had been cheated in a deal over a car.
We felt that it was drug-related, and we told Neil and Stanfield that we're not interested in their current legal problems, but that we feel like Lisa's life may be at stake and that we need to have all the information that they could provide us to help get their sister back.
Police had discounted the claims from the brothers, but had continued to investigate Beckley as a potential suspect nevertheless. In a news conference, Officer D. Anderson said that despite the arrest, Lisa's whereabouts was still not known. FBI officers and an investigator flew out to Arkansas to interview the suspects. Meanwhile, the third suspect handed himself in to El Dorado police. Sergeant David Smith, a spokesman for the El Dorado Police Department, said that police had assumed that Orlando Hall had been holding Lisa hostage somewhere. However, the final arrest squashed hopes that Lisa would be with him. A search of all of the suspects' homes turned up no clues as to where Lisa could be.
We were hoping against hope that she was still alive. And so with this in mind, agents as well as police officers who had not slept in 2 or 3 days were up searching, looking, hoping that she was still alive.
When word of the arrest got to the parents of the Hall brothers, they were quick to defend their sons. Betty Hall, their mother, said that the FBI and police were mistaken in believing that her sons were involved in Lisa's abduction. Quote, "It's totally insane. They're not the type of kids who would do something like that," end quote, she said. According to Betty, Orlando would never be involved in a kidnapping because he had 2 young daughters of his own.
"People who know Demetrius Hall and his brother Orlando don't believe they could be kidnappers. Tia Scruggs grew up with the Hall brothers."
"I just don't think that's them. Not for no revenge or nothing like that. That's just not them."
The home where police arrested Demetrius Hall and Stephen Beckley is in a working-class neighborhood in this city of 25,000. Neighbors are surprised.
"I'm just puzzled about it. I don't know if it's true or what. But it don't sound true. I mean, it don't seem to be true, not here, but anything can happen, I guess."
Another neighbor says the Hall family often left for weeks at a time, and the house was often empty.
"When you did see him, what were they like?"
"Nice, just like, just a regular neighbor. My kids played with their kids. They grew up together."
None of the neighbors say they've seen any teenage girl in recent days who may have been Lisa Renee.
As all 3 suspects were being interviewed, the FBI and investigators were trying to uncover where Lisa may be and whether or not she was still alive. Quote, "We have no idea where she is or what her condition is," end quote, said Officer Anderson. However, police and the FBI soon gathered at Pine Bluff in Arkansas. Apparently, they had received a tip that Lisa had been seen in the area that week. Havis Hester, the Jefferson County coroner, told media that he had been asked to notify the FBI immediately if a body fitting Lisa's description was found. While police were remaining tight-lipped, it was evident from their presence in Pine Bluff that something was going on. Following the arrests, the 3 men were extradited from Arkansas to Texas, where they were to face charges on kidnapping. The first of the suspects to hire a lawyer was Orlando Hall. His attorney, James Bennett, said during the extradition hearing that his client maintained his innocence and was ready to head to Texas to prove it. As the 3 men were professing their innocence, the FBI and police began focusing on the Bird Lake Nature Reserve in Pine Bluff. Bird Lake Nature Reserve was around 2 miles south of the church where Orlando Hall worked as a janitor as part of his parole. According to Robert Satkowski, the agent in charge of the Little Rock FBI office said that they were looking for evidence but would not elaborate any further. However, 1 source involved in the search confessed that they were searching for a body and other evidence such as clothing. It wasn't looking good for Lisa. Dread immediately settled in when Stephen Beckley, one of the suspects, was seen emerging from the Bird Lake Nature Reserve with law officials. Those who saw Beckley leaving the search scene said that he appeared to be crying. A number of other onlookers noticed that a shovel and a body bag was being taken to the dense woodland.
Police and FBI agents emerged from the dense brush after several hours with nothing. Some Arlington officers were there too. An FBI spokesman would not confirm they were looking for Lisa Renee's body.
"We're just continuing to conduct what we think is an integral part of the investigation."
The spokesman also won't say what or who led agents to this out-of-the-way spot, but we do know one of the 3 suspects, Stephen Beckley, was released from jail for several hours at about the same time the search was beginning. Authorities have been questioning all three men in the hopes of finding the missing teenager. But now authorities are tight-lipped about what they may have learned and why they're here.
As in any search, you're looking for specifically evidence of crimes that may have occurred, and that's what we're after.
The search is made all the more difficult by the area's very dense brush, a Pine Bluff park called the Bird Lake Natural Area.
The presence of the police and the FBI alarmed the locals of Pine Bluff, a city of around 57,000. Quote, "It's kind of scary. I have a wife and three kids, two girls and a boy. Some of them stay out past dark, and it makes you wonder whether something could happen to my family," end quote, said Joseph Warfield, a local man living nearby the search area. The second day of the search focused on the bird sanctuary area that was situated in a small park on the south side. The search area was blocked from view by piney woods, and the parking lot was used as a police staging area. Throughout the day, there was a steady stream of police officers meandering their way throughout the park. Finally, on the 3rd of October, the crushing news that a body had been discovered was announced.
It felt like a tremendous sledgehammer falling on you. We had tracked this young lady from Arlington, Texas, to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, over 200 miles, with the one hope of finding her alive. And we did not. It was as if all of the wind and all of the energy had gone out of us.
Robert Satkowski of the FBI said that the body was that of a young female, and she was wearing similar clothing that Lisa was wearing when she was abducted. The body had been found around 3/4 of a mile off a paved trail. The grave site had been carefully concealed using dirt, leaves, and pine needles. Joel Stevens of Arlington, Texas Police recalls the discovery of the body.
We made contact with Lisa's body approximately 2 feet down from the surface, the outer surface of the dirt, and then started uncovering her and really excavating around the body from that point on down to the four feet level. This lasted for about 5.5 hours. That it took us to fully extract her from the gravesite.
Satkowski announced that the body was now being sent to the state crime lab for positive identification, but said that he was pretty certain that it was Lisa. Lisa's family reluctantly gave up hope that Lisa would be found alive. Quote, "We're almost positive that it's her," end quote, said a tearful Diane Renee, Lisa's sister. Tragically, they were correct. The body was identified as Lisa Renee. Her autopsy concluded that she had died of asphyxia due to obstruction of the airway and blunt force trauma. Lisa had been sexually assaulted before being beaten with a shovel and then buried alive.
During the time we were exhuming her body, one of the agents on the evidence response team accidentally scrapes her knee. The agent breaks down. And I break down. Because we know now that she's dead. This week that we have spent trying to locate her has resulted in the recovery of her, but not the recovery of her in that she was not alive.
As news of the identification wended through the streets of Arkansas and Texas, a fourth and fifth suspect were arrested in connection with Lisa's abduction. 21-year-old Bruce Webster of Pine Bluff was arrested on an aggravated kidnapping warrant, while 23-year-old Marvin Holloway of Pine Bluff was arrested on a warrant for conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Webster was arrested at a motel where police now believed that Lisa had been held for 2 days before it was decided that she should be killed. The day after Lisa's body was identified, a memorial service was held. Around 200 people packed into the North Davis Church of Christ to commemorate the short life of Lisa. She was remembered through hymns, prayers, and through her own words, which she had inscribed in her Bible. Quote, the Bible, the living word. I love the Lord, oh yes, with all my heart, and lean not to thy own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy path, end quote, she wrote. Lisa's family sat on the front pew holding a red rose. Lisa and her siblings were regulars at the church, and it seemed like a fitting place to begin the grieving process. As Lisa's family were trying to comprehend what happened, it was announced that federal authorities would be retaining jurisdiction over the kidnapping and murder. This decision made the case the very first death penalty case to be prosecuted under the new federal crime bill. According to the new crime bill, which had been signed by President Clinton on the 13th of September, a kidnapping that ends with a killing can be punishable by death. Lisa's brothers, Stanfield and Neil, were arrested by customs officials on a federal warrant, accusing them of smuggling a pound of crack cocaine from the Virgin Islands. They appeared before Magistrate John Toll, but didn't enter a plea. Several days later, a federal affidavit was released which detailed Lisa's final terrifying moments on Earth. According to the affidavit, Holloway was not present when Lisa was abducted, but provided the four other suspects money to rent the motel where Lisa was kept and allowed them to borrow his car. The affidavit described how on the 20th or 21st of September, Orlando Hall and Beckley gave $5,000 to Lisa's brothers to buy marijuana. The brothers promised to deliver the drugs, but instead they kept the cash and produced no drugs. Following the botched deal, Hall phoned Holloway to inform him that he had been robbed and asked him to call Webster. It was the Hall brothers, Beckley and Webster, who participated in the abduction. Lisa was driven to the motel room where she was bound to a chair with a stocking covering her head. When Holloway came to the motel and saw Lisa, he said he wanted nothing to do with what was going on, but offered the four men use of his car. In a cruel twist of fate, Lisa was almost inadvertently rescued by an Arkansas state trooper as her kidnappers were driving her to the Pine Bluff Motel. The state trooper had attempted to pull them over. However, Orlando Hall, who was following in another car, managed to divert the trooper's attention to him instead by veering off the road and driving erratically, forcing the trooper to pursue him instead. It was Beckley who confessed to the crime to police following his arrest, and it was Beckley who led them to Lisa's body. Shortly after the affidavit was released, Holloway was released on an unsecured $50,000 signature bond. Federal kidnapping charges were filed against Holloway, Webster, Beckley, and the Hall brothers. All five pleaded not guilty and were scheduled to stand trial in 1996. As the prosecution was preparing for the upcoming trial, Lisa's brothers, Stanfield and Neil, pleaded guilty to federal drug charges. It was soon announced that federal prosecutors would be seeking the death penalty against Orlando Hall and Beckley, who were described as being the ringleaders and the ones who beat Lisa with the shovel. The two men were to become the first in the nation to face the death penalty under the new federal crime bill. Then in July of 1995, Demetrius Hall pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit kidnapping in a plea agreement under which he agreed to testify against his four co-defendants, including his brother. According to Demetrius, he participated in the kidnapping and he raped Lisa on the trip back to Pine Bluff. However, he said that he was ordered to clean up the motel room while the others took Lisa to the Bird Lake Nature Reserve, where she was killed. If Demetrius were to abide by the terms of the agreement, the federal kidnapping and aiding and abetting charges against him would be dropped. Shortly thereafter, Beckley and Holloway followed suit and also pleaded guilty to kidnapping charges in exchange for lighter sentences and their testimony against Orlando Hall and Webster in court. The first of the suspects to stand trial was Orlando Hall, and his trial was slated for October of 1995. During opening statements, one of his defense attorneys, Michael Ware, told the courtroom that all five men had played a part in the abduction and murder of Lisa Renee, adding that his client had only played a minor role. According to Ware, Orlando had no idea that Lisa was going to be taken hostage and said that he had only wanted to get back some of the money that Lisa's brothers owed him. One of the first witnesses called by prosecution was Orlando's own brother, Demetrius Hall. With a clear lack of emotion, Demetrius relayed the events leading up to Lisa's murder. He told the courtroom how he, Orlando, Beckley and Webster dressed up in camouflage and armed themselves with two handguns and a baseball bat and headed to Lisa's apartment. He claimed that they had hoped that Lisa's brothers would be in. Demetrius testified that when they broke into the apartment, Webster tackled Lisa to the ground. Demetrius testified that he and Webster both raped Lisa on the car ride to Pine Bluff, and then Beckley raped her inside the motel room. According to Demetrius, it was Orlando, Beckley, and Webster that took Lisa to Bird Lake Nature Reserve and killed her. He said that on their return to the motel room, Beckley told them that they had killed Lisa. Demetrius recollected to the packed courtroom that while Lisa was held hostage in the Pine Bluff Motel, she spent almost all of her time crying and praying. The next to take the stand was Stephen Beckley. Beckley relayed Lisa's final moments on Earth, and the description was enough to make the majority of the courtroom weep.
He told us a story that the grave was 6 foot deep, and that when she went to the grave, when she... Bruce Webster, Orlando Hall, and he, Stephen Beckley, arrived at the grave, that she saw the grave.
Come on.
And that she started to run in an effort to get away. And that they struck at her with a shovel.
Beckley testified how Lisa was forced to stand in front of her grave before Orlando hit her across the face with a shovel. Quote, Orlando turned her facing the opposite direction of the grave with her back facing the grave and hit her with the shovel. She screamed and started running, end quote. Beckley said that Lisa took off running into the woods, but said that he took off after her and managed to catch her. Quote, all I could do was put my hand over her mouth and I said, please don't fight, please don't fight. I got up and she was quiet, end quote, he testified. Beckley said that he took Lisa back to the grave where he hit her over the head with the shovel twice, before Webster and Orlando then took turns striking her with the shovel. He said that they probably hit Lisa with the shovel around 15 to 20 times. While Demetrius didn't mention it, Beckley said that Orlando had also raped Lisa and forced her to perform oral sex on him. On the third day of testimony, Lisa's brother, Stanfield, took to the stand. He admitted that if he had just told the truth about the drug deal, then Lisa could have been saved. According to Stanfield, he and his brother Neil decided to double-cross Orlando and Beckley because they had mounting legal fees they needed to pay from their earlier drug charges. During the emotional trial, the court was shown graphic photographs of Lisa's corpse. As the blown-up photograph of Lisa's bruised and bloody face was shown to jurors, a crime scene investigator testified that Lisa was found in a fetal position in the grave with both of her hands covering her face. As a final element of terror, Frank Peretti, chief medical examiner of the Arkansas State Crime Lab, told the court that there was a chance that while in the grave, Lisa may have gained consciousness and that she had numerous defensive wounds on her arms. Orlando's defense lawyers presented no witnesses, but at one point, Orlando could be overheard pressing them for a chance to testify on his own behalf. After just 5 hours of deliberation, the jury found Orlando Hall guilty. During the sentencing phase, Orlando's defense lawyers attempted to save him from a death sentence by portraying him as a good father and the victim of an abusive childhood. Prosecutors, on the other hand, painted him as a remorseless killer. In a bid to save Orlando's life, his lawyers told the jury how as a young boy, Orlando's father, AJ Hall, frequently beat Orlando's mother, Betty Hall, as well as beat Orlando himself. They called Betty to the stand and she detailed how she was routinely beat by her husband with his fists or the butt of a gun. Under cross-examination by prosecutors, Betty admitted that her son always had food on the table, clothing on his back, a home, and that he went to church regularly. Orlando's lawyers also said that his confession, which came on the 5th of October, shows acceptance of responsibility as well as remorse. Prosecutors, however, refuted that Orlando showed remorse. They called three of Orlando's girlfriends who testified that after killing Lisa, Orlando didn't appear upset, and he even hassled them for sex. They also called a former cellmate of Orlando, who testified that Orlando had two shanks in his cell and that he boasted to escape from prison, take his lawyers hostage, and stab U.S. District Judge Terry Means. The same inmate told the jury that Orlando had even laughed about killing Lisa and joked that he had used a condom when he raped her. While one mother in the courtroom was begging for the life of her son, another was sitting just feet away, weeping for her dead daughter. The emotion in the courtroom spilled over when Agnes Renee, Lisa's mother, testified about her daughter. She told the jury that Lisa had made numerous academic awards and was an honor roll student. She reminisced that Lisa had ambitions to become a doctor. In a written impact statement, Lisa's father, Nicholson Renee, wrote that Lisa's death was killing him slowly inside. Quote, "Lisa was an angel. She was everyone's sunshine on a cloudy day. She was the type of person who was always concerned about your feelings, never selfish, always giving," end quote, he said. After deliberating for around 8.5 hours, Orlando Hall was sentenced to death. Next to face the jury was Bruce Webster. His trial was slated for June of 1996. Defense attorneys decided against making an opening statement. Once again, Demetrius Hall testified as a prosecution witness. He said that when it became dark on the night of Lisa's abduction, it was Webster that decided it was time to take action, and that it was Webster who tackled Lisa and dragged her into the waiting car. Both Demetrius and Stephen Beckley relayed the murder much like they did in the first trial. Beckley said that after Lisa ran away and he dragged her back, he couldn't put her in the grave. He told the courtroom how Webster then pushed him out of the way and dragged Lisa to the grave, exclaiming, "See, man, that wasn't hard." In closing arguments, Assistant U.S. Richard Report implored the jury to recall an FBI agent's testimony that Webster referred to Lisa's abduction and murder as simply business. When the FBI agent asked Webster how he would have felt if it was a member of his family that had been abducted and murdered, Webster replied, "Shit happens." During the defense's closing arguments, lawyer Larry Moore argued that the case against Webster was based on the testimony of unfaithful men. In a sarcastic rebuttal, Assistant U.S. Richard Report said, quote, "Poor Bruce Webster, poor old Bruce Webster, gee whiz, I wish I could have called the priest who was down there doing that kidnapping," end quote. He also reminded the jury that there was physical evidence against Webster, including Lisa's Gucci necklace that Webster was wearing when he was arrested, and the key to the motel room in Pine Bluff where Lisa was held hostage. After just 75 minutes of deliberation, the jury found Bruce Webster guilty. During the sentencing phase, Webster's family gave horrific accounts of his childhood in a bid to save his life. While growing up, Webster and his 8 siblings were forced by their father, Willie Webster, to eat each other's excrement and perform sex acts on one another. His father frequently beat the children, zapped them with electrical currents, whipped them with hoses and belts, and hit them with fireplace pokers. The defense also presented testimony from several psychologists. Raymond Finn reported that Webster scored very low on intelligence tests and may have suffered from a mental disability. Dennis Keyes testified that Webster's intellectual level was below that of 99.8% of the population. Prosecutors were quick to refute these claims, stating that Webster could quote scripture at length, studied law books, and even wrote a coded letter plotting to meet female inmates for sex in the Manfield Jail visitor area. The defense had hoped that descriptions of Webster's childhood combined with the testimony from the psychologist would encourage the jury to consider this a mitigating factor when deciding what punishment would be appropriate. After deliberating for 10 hours, the jury decided that Bruce Webster should die for his role in the abduction and murder of Lisa Renee. Outside court, Pearl spoke to the media.
"I thought I'd feel better, but I really don't. Because, I mean, it's not going to bring her back. The only thing that's going to make it better is Lisa was here today, and she's not coming back."
The other 3 defendants were sentenced to prison terms, ranging from 15 to 30 years. Now, one would imagine that the traumatic murder of their sister would set her brothers on the path to better themselves and get out of the drug trade. However, in 2012, Neil Renee was arrested for being the ringleader of a large drug trafficking ring that shipped hundreds of kilograms of marijuana from Arlington to the Virgin Islands. With this revelation, Richard Roper, the former US attorney who prosecuted Lisa's killer, said, quote, "You would have hoped he would have changed his ways, but that's exactly why he got in trouble. He got into things that led to a series of events that led to the murder of his sister, Lisa, who is completely innocent. They sexually assaulted her until they were finished with her, and then they killed her. You would have thought that he would have learned his lesson from it, but evidently he didn't. I just feel sorry for Mrs. Renee having to go through this in light of already losing a daughter," end quote. Neil Renee was subsequently sentenced to 12 years in prison after pleading guilty to one count of conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute a controlled substance. Then in 2019, attorneys for Bruce Webster challenged his death sentence, stating that previously unavailable evidence showed that Webster was intellectually disabled before his trial. According to attorneys, Webster had an IQ of 69 or lower. Senior U.S. District Judge William Lawrence ruled that Webster's intellectual disability was known when Webster was a child and decided to overturn Webster's death sentence. Orlando Hall still resides on death row.
When you find out that you were that close to possibly saving this kidnapped victim from her demise, as it turned out, It hurts in that you wish you could kind of go back in time and do something different than you did. But under the conditions that we had and the information we had to work with, we felt like we did as good as we could. Unfortunately, it wasn't good enough to save Lisa. It just solidified the fact that things can happen to people who are completely and totally unrelated to criminal activities. No one is exempt from the possibility that for no real reason of their own, they get put in a position where their life is in jeopardy. And Lisa Renee is a prime example of someone that in the years that I've been doing this, she is actually probably the most innocent victim that I've ever worked a case on. And it's something that we'd all need to remember, that even if you're an innocent victim, you can still be a victim.
Hindsight of a traumatic event can lead to a lifetime of nightmares and regret. Seemingly for Lisa Renee's brother, this wasn't the case. Sadly, children don't have the choice to pick their families or the people that their families associate themselves with or the business that they conduct. In the tragic case of Lisa Renee, adults made a stupid decision and a child paid the ultimate price for them. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, I'd like to thank you so, so much for listening. I'd also like to give a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporter, Jennifer Knuth. Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support really does go a long way in helping the podcast continue to grow. So thank you. I'd also like to thank everybody who has taken the time to leave a nice review on iTunes and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. We also have a podcast promo at the end of this episode for the amazing true crime podcast, Suspiria. So stay tuned for that. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
True crime is one of the biggest genres in podcasting right now. And if you're a fan, chances are that you think you've heard of every single case that's out there. Well, if you're looking for a new podcast to binge, try Suspiria, a true crime podcast.
Every week, we cover interesting, outrageous, and unbelievable crimes that happen all over Latin America or involving Latin people, all through the voices of me, Carol,
and me, Stephanie. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, CastBox, Overcast, and many other streaming services. So check us out.
Ciao.
Ciao.